Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast, sponsored by Bell, a Textron company. I'm your host, Vagha Mradian. Last week, the National Defense Strategy Commission issued its assessment of the Trump administration's national security strategy. Budgetary uncertainty continues with a potential looming fight between the Senate and the House over the Pentagon's spending limits. The incoming chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Washington Democrat Adam Smith, talked about nuclear weapons, telegraphing how he may look at a key modernization effort for the U.S. military. And President Trump has a bad weekend in Paris at the centenary of the end of the war to end all wars. Joining us to discuss the week are Susanna Bloom of the Center for a New American Security, Evelyn Farkas, who served in the Obama administration overseeing NATO and Russia policy, who's now at the German Marshall Fund, Steve Grundman of Grundman Advisory and the Atlantic Council, and former Pentagon Comptroller Bob Hale, who now advises Booz Allen Hamilton. His views are his own. And I should also point out that Bob and Susanna also served in the Obama administration. Guys, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vagha. Hi.
Thanks, Vagha.
Great to be here.
Good to be here, Vagha.
Glad to have you all back on. Obviously, the National Defense Strategy Commission, I called it, interviewed Bridge Colby last week, who was one of the architects of the strategy, is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Planning, a big mouthful, who's at CNAS, Susanna, with you. And I called it the National Defense Panel, which only merely dates me. But, you know, a comprehensive effort, but a lot of debate about whether or not that changes or affects the vector of what we're on. Talk to us a little bit about some of the major takeaways from that report.
Sure. So the National Defense Strategy Commission report, the kind of headline there is that they, validated or concurred with the National Defense Strategy's focus on strategic competition with China and Russia. Which is kind of a great, you know, reflection of the fact that there really is a bipartisan consensus out there that these are the, the primary security challenges that we need to invest our time and energy in thinking about. The report goes on, in some ways, the failing of the National Defense Strategy Commission report is similar to the failing of the National Defense Strategy itself. And that it, while it agrees with that kind of top line prioritization, it has a hard time, figuring out how to scale back some of our other commitments in order to make room to give the China and Russia challenges the focus that they need, particularly in terms of time and energy and planning, but most particularly in terms of resources. And I was pleased to see that it's called out, this resource issue is called out really predominantly in just the executive summary at the very top of the document. Kind of making the claim, even with this significant increase that we saw for 2018 and 2019, I think the line is, America is very near the point of strategic insolvency, and that's a quote, where its means are badly out of alignment with its ends. And so that's a little bit of a warning for all concerned.
The issue is, right, it doesn't prioritize anything. It just says more money, and who wouldn't like more money? Bob, you had to struggle with prioritization and more money or not more money and budgetary uncertainty. How did you read the report?
Well, Vagha, I agree with what Susanna said, but let me mention a specific nugget in that report, which is they called for 3-5% real, that is inflation-adjusted growth in the defense budget, at least for the next 5 years, if not longer. I think that's just wildly unrealistic, given that we just saw the Democrats come in. Mr. Smith has said maybe less defense. I'd note back in February, the Gallup poll service, which has been polling the public on defense spending for the last 50 years, that only about a third of the public supports more defense spending. That was February before the big increase. So, my takeaway is the 3-5 ain't going to happen. And what we'll need to see from the Pentagon, and it may have to come from Congress, is some reprioritization and probably some willingness to accept greater risk. That's how you ultimately balance budgets or the money that's available with a strategy, is you talk about the risks that you're willing to take. People don't like talking about them But they're real, or they have to be real. And we're just not going to get 3 to 5% growth. The president just recommended a 2% cut for 2020 in the budget, let alone 3 to 5% growth. So on the resource side, I think the commission was just kind of, as I said, wildly unrealistic.
Steve?
You know, what strikes me about the report is the allusion, or at least the echo, to the Committee on the Present Danger. Those of you old enough to remember 1977 and the era right after the Vietnam War, and in some respect as a critique of the Carter administration's foreign and defense policy, there emerged this Committee on the Present Danger, which quietly at first and insistently ultimately, and I think some part of the members of this committee became a lot of the figures in the Reagan administration. They were calling out for attention in exactly the kinds of words, emergency, crisis, that this commission is invoking, an unpreparedness of our military forces to deal with the Soviet threat around the world. This report of this commission has that feel to it, but what I guess I'm tempted to say disturbs me or worries me about it is that the context is altogether different. We have a way better military force today than we did in 1977. It is way more capable of addressing the challenges before it than was the force of 1977 able to address the challenge of the Soviet forces. And we are spending as much money today on defense as we did at the very height of the Cold War, let alone toward the bottom of the cycle, which we were at in 1977. So the clarion is as strong and alarming as it was then, but the context feels differently, and I don't read anything in the report to rectify those two things or rationalize them, if you will.
And shout out to Paul Nitze, of course, who spearheaded that effort, if memory serves correctly.
He was a leading light of it.
He was a leading light of it. So I apologize for misstating any of our audience who participated in that. Contact me, because we would love to talk to you about it. Evelyn, talk to us a little bit. You know, nuclear is a place where the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee sees an opportunity there. Obviously, the administration has put forward a very ambitious nuclear modernization agenda, including tactical weapons, the whole variety of sort of recapitalization of the nuclear enterprise. In fairness, that effort began under the last administration that sort of bounded the problem and identified it. There's always been a debate about whether it should be a triad or a dyad. And you know, we saw Adam Smith, the Washington Democrat, who was going to become the new chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, succeeding Mac Thornberry, make some comments on that. Talk to us a little bit about nuclear planning and potential opportunities, right? Because the tactical nuclear arsenal is less for us, but more for our NATO allies to reassure them and get them as participants in our nuclear umbrella, whether they're weapons that are based in Italy and Turkey or elsewhere. So talk to us a little bit about what the sort of trade space here and what the thinking may be and how does it affect our allies.
Right. I mean, I would start, Vago, by making a segue from the commission report where they basically said, yes, we have a strong military, but we have these adversaries who are hell-bent on taking us down. It's not an issue of resources per se. It's an issue of prioritization. So Adam Smith comes into the picture and says, yeah, I agree. And I don't think we should prioritize our spending on the nuclear force. Not only that, but I think that our whole approach from a policy perspective is wrong. And if we change the approach, we can also save money. So he's saying, basically, I want a deterrent force. He's not a nuclear zero guy. He was pretty clear in that forum.
And even though it was the Plowshares Fund, right? Joe Cirincione's
right. So I'm
outfit
sure Joe,
that is anti-nuclear.
Exactly. I'm sure they wanted him to, sign up to agree with them across the board. But he said, no, you know, I'm for a deterrent nuclear posture, but I'm not for, you know, just build all the capability you can. And I'm not for a race with Russia on the tactical front. So he was basically saying, you know, I don't think he used the words in danger, but he was advocating against creating a new low-yield submarine launched nuclear weapon, which many nuclear experts feel would be destabilizing. Also, frankly speaking, a lot of it, you know, mirror images what the Russians are talking about, which is not helpful. because the Russians, by talking about and emphasizing nuclear weapons, and by the way, also talking about the right to first use, only highlight the nuclear weapon as a potentially useful weapon, which is not what we want to do. We want to make it obviously a weapon of last resort. And so you've seen in the Twitter sphere, for example, former Secretary of Defense Perry saying, you know, we need to maintain the nuclear taboo. So Smith is saying we need to maintain the nuclear taboo. Let's not build new nuclear weapons. Let's do kind of the minimum we need to do in order to keep our deterrence credible and focus our efforts elsewhere. And then, in addition to that, he calls out the administration for their approach to arms control. Now, it's a little bit unclear exactly what the administration's approach is to arms control. And so Joe and I have debated this, Joe Cerencione and I have debated the issue of where the administration's going, for example, on the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, where they've said, the administration has said that they're going to withdraw from the treaty. I gave him a little break because it could be potentially a negotiating position to say that they're going to withdraw. Because frankly speaking, you know, had it been a Hillary Clinton administration, we probably would have been at the point now where we were trying something like that with the Russians, because negotiation wasn't getting us anywhere.
Right.
But people who are very distrustful, like Joe, of John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, think that it's all of, and Tim Morrison, who's also in the NSC, people who are known to be skeptics of arms control working for President Trump now. Those people, like Joe Cerencione, do not trust the anti-arms control folks, and so they see everything as being an assault on arms control. It remains to be seen, obviously.
There's another side of the argument too, right? Because there are those who look at this at what the Russians are doing as the real destabilizing factor, and unless we position ourselves with like capabilities, it won't inject enough deterrence into their form of thinking, which is to, you know, regard a tactical nuclear weapon, for example, as a potential opening salvo of an exchange. Susanna, I want to bring you in because you've been thinking about this issue as well, both in and out of government.
I think that this is indicative of a broader dynamic that we're going to see play out between the new, HASC under Adam Smith's leadership in the administration. You know, a lot of the news surrounding the midterm elections has been about, the Democratic House exerting more oversight of the administration. And the focus has, for obvious reasons, been on, you know, the president's business dealings and the way he ran his campaign, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that Democratic controlled Armed Services Committee in the House is also going to really push back against the administration, not just the president, but the broader administration on a lot of these foreign policy issues. And Adam Smith has put down a very clear marker that the nuclear posture review is going to be one of the first things that he wants to kind of look at. Other issues include the Yemen War Powers Resolution that, just failed because the House is still controlled by Republicans. That issue is going to resurface, I think, in the new Congress, and a number of other things. And so there's certainly going to be a more interesting dynamic between the Hill and the executive branch coming up, and nuclear policy and posture is one of the first issues I think we all need to be focused on.
In a minute, I want to bring Steve into this, but Bob, I want to go to you. I mean, a lot of this is about trying to make ends meet, right? And right now, I think that people who are not in government don't recognize exactly how busy a time it is for everybody in the department as everybody races to try to build their budgets, do that exchange back and forth with OMB and get all the documents in to get a budget in February. Talk to us a little bit about the uncertainty here about whether it's 700, 716, 733, and how this drill is going to play out, because you sort of saw this one coming a couple of weeks ago when we first talked about it.
Well, Vago, I've been through a number of these as the comptroller. First, I think what the department's doing, what the deputy secretary has said, is that they're building two budgets. They'd already built one or were in the end game of building one to 733. They're going to go back now to build one at 700. what they'll do, or have done already probably, is go out to the services and ask them for how would they trim back. In my experience, you never get too much. Everybody's kind of settled on 733 and comfortable with the choices. But they'll have to make changes. You can't do much on military personnel this late in the game. Maybe trim a little bit of the ads in personnel if there were, but it won't save much money. Readiness is probably sacrosanct. Although it's important to realize that readiness is only perhaps a third of the day-to-day operating budget, the so-called operation and maintenance budget in the Department of Defense. So there'll be areas where they can trim in non-readiness operating dollars, cutting back on contracts, IT. But a lot of it will end up coming out of investment, military construction, and also procurement. And at least in my experience, that probably the procurement changes will be more in what I call non-major procurement. There may be some trims and things like the F-35, but a lot of it's going to come out of the hundreds of programs in DOD that I probably wouldn't even recognize in terms of their name. So, and then Mattis, at some point, probably in early December, I assume we'll go back to the president and say, you know, I really need 733 or something close. And I'm not good at predicting this president, so I'm not sure where that will come out. But I'd be surprised, if it went all the way down to 700. But I'd also be surprised if it ended up at 733. We're probably going to end up somewhere in between. And that will be the starting point for a debate and to go back next year in the Congress. And at that point, I think the strategy commission that we just talked about will play a role, because certainly those advocating higher defense numbers will cite its crisis words and argue for their case. So still a lot of uncertainty, as there always is. Busy time at the Pentagon. My bottom line, we probably end up somewhere between 7 and 733, but I think it's clearly in that range.
Let me ask you quickly about DHS, right? The Department of Homeland Security and other agencies. We interviewed the Coast Guard Commandant recently, Carl Schultz. And everybody has this tendency of thinking, oh, you know, everybody's gotten the pass and the Budget Control Act has been flexed. And at the end of the day, they did not get relief. They got some increases for certain things that they wanted to do, but they still live under budget pressure. Talk to us about other departments and how they could be affected, because a lot of other guys are playing in national security beyond just the Pentagon.
Well, I think there are seven major agencies that are on continuing resolutions right now. Homeland Security is one of them. So is State, Commerce, Treasury, Agriculture. There are a number of them. And, you know, their clock runs out on December 7th when the current continuing resolution expires. I think there's general agreement about funding of the levels for these agencies. What there is an agreement is about whether there'll be money in there for the border wall. And the president has been adamant that he wants that money. I think the Democrats are saying no, unless he's willing to compromise in a major way on immigration reform, which seems unlikely at this point. So, yeah, we're heading to another crisis for those agencies. Won't affect DOD because they have an appropriation through next September. But it most assuredly could affect some other important national security agencies. Homeland Security and State come immediately to mind.
Evelyn, the president had a very, very tough weekend in Paris. Normally, people don't have tough weekends in Paris. He had a tough weekend in Paris. I've been in Paris many times. I've never had a tough weekend, but he did. You know, talk to us, you know, the rhetoric. You know, he had a bromance with Emmanuel Macron. That seems to be over. Over the issue of a European army. There's a discussion that there was a mutual misunderstanding and try to paper it over, but then the president put a Twitter broadside out. He skipped a visit to a military cemetery, a very important one, obviously, on the commemoration of the centenary of the end of World War I. Joe Dunford went, and so did John Kelly, obviously both Marines, to a battlefield that is very, very important to Marines. And really the founding of a lot of the, you know, modern Marine ethos comes from there. Talk to us a little bit about how you see this affecting the transatlantic relationship, which has, you know, there was still foundationally remains strong. But every once in a while, when people think that the stresses have been healed, there's sort of a new shock to the system.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, Vago, what Emmanuel Macron was doing you know, in terms of the statements that he made, leaving aside the exact words that he spoke, he was essentially joining Chancellor Angela Merkel, who had already said that if we need to, Europe will have to fend for itself. Essentially, what they're saying is that we don't believe that America is a reliable partner, a reliable ally anymore. It's pretty shocking. And, you know, all I can say as somebody who is a very fervent Atlanticist is that, you know, hopefully this president doesn't get a second term, because at this point it is manageable. The Europeans will probably hang in there for two more years. But if it continues like this, NATO will fall apart. Our transatlantic relationship, trade, economic, political, military, will not survive if this president continues to assault it. And frankly speaking, the world order will fall apart, because the international institutions and the entire world order, the global trade system, et cetera, is predicated upon this transatlantic relationship. And, you know, I can go into more detail on that, but it also connects very clearly with Macron's statement about nationalism and the impact of nationalism, how nationalism brought about World War I and World War II, and the international institutions that we set up, we the United States with our allies after World War II, were set up in order to prevent a return to global competition, balance of power politics, by the way, the very thing that that defense panel was warning about. So, but here we have an American president who's saying, these are outdated. We're getting a bad deal. We need to get rid of the WTO. We need to get rid of NATO. We need to, what's this EU? It's a bad deal. I mean, if you let the erosion and the assault continue against these international institutions, the multilateral order that we set up after World War II, then we will have war again. And that's basically what, unfortunately, our president refuses to understand.
David O'Sullivan, the EU's ambassador to the United States, I think says it most eloquently, that Europe throughout its history has produced more nationalism than it can consume, which is one of the reasons why even Winston Churchill and really all the people who were there at the foundation of the EU thought it was, you know, a very, very good idea. And it's actually a security thing to sort of fuse the nations together in a way that makes another conflict unlikely. And there were obviously fast moving events in London as the UK continues, and Theresa May continues her drive toward an orderly Brexit. And clearly we'll have an update for people on Monday on that.
Bogo,
yes.
Yeah. I wonder, Steve, if I could add the following thought. I mean, I would rely on Evelyn to correct me if I'm wrong, but there's irony to add to the insult that the president leveled against the president of France, President Trump leveled against the president of France, because a European security and defense identity is something that we have asked Europeans to do, or at least as a project, which as part of the European project has been at least traditionally something endorsed by the United States. And while I don't know and wouldn't purport to have translated exactly what President Macron said, it certainly sounded a lot to me like the European project of having a European security and defense identity, longstanding, endorsed by the United States.
That's correct. I will say there was a time when the United States was wary about what the Europeans were proposing and whether it would lead to a competition for defense resources between NATO and the European Union. That was largely in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it subsided, I would argue, toward maybe already towards part of the end of the Bush administration, but certainly under President Obama, there was a kind of a full force, full steam ahead, let's encourage the Europeans. Also because we all recognized, and that's why I say it probably started under the Bush administration, we all recognized that countering the threats of today, to include the non-state actors, terrorists, et cetera, but also Russia, China, et cetera, require law enforcement capabilities which are not NATO competencies.
And also
they're EU competencies.
There are operations that the Europeans might like to undertake that we don't need to be involved in, Mali, Libya, all around the Mediterranean, which right now they absolutely rely upon us to undertake. And so we get implicated in those things when it may or may not be in our national interest to do so.
In about 10 seconds, because we are well over time, what you guys are paying attention to over the coming week, Evelyn?
Jamal Khashoggi, and basically the administration and Congress's response to the horrific murder. The sanctions that were announced today are insufficient. Frankly speaking, the Turkish government and our government should not settle for anything less than a new succession order in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Wow. Tall order, and obviously the Saudis are saying they want the death penalty for some sentences for others, as the United States has sanctioned those involved. Steve?
I've got my eye on this this mini government closure, which is impending, I think, on, of all dates, the 7th of December. I still think a deal's got to be struck, and it's got to involve the wall, let's call it, before another, you know, conflagration doesn't break out in the first week of December.
Bob, are you going to be paying attention to that? And do you think that that's a real worry?
Well, yes, for sure. And yes, I think it's a real worry. As I said, it's hard to predict this president, and he's the key. And if I go, I'll resort to my comfortable rule and say DOD is about to roll out the results of its audit for the last fiscal year. The details are only of interest to comptrollers, but it will be a symbol of how the administration is doing on its reform efforts. And we haven't heard too much from them. This will be the first major thing we hear sometime probably over the next week or two.
Well, in that case, we definitely have to have you on, and maybe we can get Dov Zakheim and some other illustrious comptrollers to join, you know, Mike McCord, your successor, to discuss that. And Susanna, you get the last word.
Sure, Vago. I'm going to be watching for additional signals from Adam Smith and others in terms of what's coming in the new Congress in the foreign policy, national security space.
Fantastic. Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. And like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. Thanks again to Bell, a Textron company, for their generous sponsorship. And until we're together again, have a great week.